when I talk about microdosing, what I'm really referring to is using lower doses of the medication with not really the goal being weight loss, but more controlling what you put in your body. And I think that the most important decision we make on a day-to-day basis is the kind of food that we eat and the stuff we put in our body. There's a lot of longevity influencers that would say exercise is the most important intervention. I think it's food. And with all the processed food out there, and the simple carbs and the way, especially with the American diet, that is, I think, a major driver of cardiometabolic risk.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, which is brought to you by Wisenetics. And I'm Stefan Trapp from University College London. And I'm dedicated here to bring you the latest insights and discussions in the GLP-1 field. So get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. So for today's episode, I have with me here Dr. Jason Itry. He is a physician. He's a founder of the Longevity Health Clinic in Charlottesville, Virginia. And quoting from his website, I can say he founded the Longevity Health Clinic to address the shortcomings in traditional medical practice. His vision is to provide comprehensive personalized care that addresses all aspects of health. And so I believe you're particularly interested in cardiometabolic health. And with that, you got very much interested in GLP-1 based therapies. But probably it's the best if you just tell us a bit about yourself and how you got there and what your background is.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and discuss this topic. I think GLP-1s, it's a great topic right now. There's a lot of interest. It's a great medication. My personal interest, I'm originally a diagnostic radiologist. And what shifted my practice was actually a lot of my own health problems. Very poor lifestyle in terms of stress and sleep and diet and exercise. And in my mid-30s, found out I was low T. I had blood pressure readings, 160 over 110. I was on 3 blood pressure medications. And I realized that traditional medical training really didn't prepare me to manage those issues beyond just writing prescriptions. And I figured out pretty quickly that the prescriptions only take you so far and they kind of treat the symptoms. They don't really treat the root causes. So from that radiology background, I actually went back and spent 2 years getting functional medicine training because I realized in treating patients that, you can only get people so far with the prescriptions. It's really, you have to focus on the nutrition, the exercise, the stress, and the sleep. That's where you get patients to feel really good and really benefit. My personal interest, I had a coronary calcium score that put me, my 10-year risk of non-fatal MI and stroke was over 20%. And I had 2 young kids. And that was really my internal motivator to figure out how to take much better care of myself. And that started, several years ago, I got started on the longevity pathway and learned a lot about it and then realized what I was doing with myself was what a lot of patients wanted that they weren't getting from their general practice physicians. They get a 15-minute meeting and then get prescribed a statin. And that really isn't doing justice to what patients want. They know they need more. They know they need to work on the lifestyle issues. So that's my background. Now I have a functional medicine clinic where I treat patients. I've been doing that for about a year and a half. And a big part of what I do is using GLP-1s because they're much more than just weight loss medications. We're going to get into that, but that's my background.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Okay, yes, that's very interesting. And of course, regarding GLP-1, I mean, I would agree also from my own science background that, of course, GLP-1s are important as incretins in diabetes. They have the weight loss effects. There are effects on the cardiovascular system and so on and so on. So you were particularly interested in improving cardiovascular risk beyond the weight loss alone. So and also you've been talking about microdosing to me previously. So can you give us a little bit of insight there on both of these points?
Yeah, and I'll start with the microdosing part because I'm not sure there's a standard definition for microdosing. But when I talk about microdosing, what I'm really referring to is using lower doses of the medication with not really the goal being weight loss, but more controlling what you put in your body. And I think that the most important decision we make on a day-to-day basis is the kind of food that we eat and the stuff we put in our body. There's a lot of longevity influencers that would say exercise is the most important intervention. I think it's food. And with all the processed food out there, and the simple carbs and the way, especially with the American diet, that is, I think, a major driver of cardiometabolic risk is what we're eating. And when I talk about microdosing, the goal for my patients is developing the right habits rather than weight loss, rather than any other goal. It's getting the right habits. And there's kind of two components to that. One is being in a state of calorie restriction, which has a whole host of longevity benefits, and then also food choices. I think that's when you look at most of the benefits of the GLP-1 medications, it's not some magical synthetic drug, right? It influences calorie excess and food choices, and that's where the majority of the benefits are. And now there's research that shows it helps people stop drinking and stop smoking too, because it disrupts that pleasure cycle. So for me, when I prescribe it for a lot of my patients, it's to get much more control over their daily habits, because a lot of people know what they should be eating. They know they shouldn't be drinking. They know what the healthy habits are. It's just such a struggle with the stresses of our daily life to control those urges. And really where the GLP-1s are incredibly valuable is in giving you more control over what you eat and when you eat and how you eat and what your habits are. And the longer you can, when you set a good healthy habit, it takes minimum of like 70 to 90 days for those habits to really settle in and become hardwired. And even longer than that for them to override the old habits. So really, microdosing for me is about getting much better habits and much better control.
Sorry, if I can just interject at this point. So the dose that you, of course, we are using different doses for diabetes and for weight loss in any case. So to have the effects on diabetes, we don't need as much as to get the very substantial weight loss that we see with the Wegovy. So in that respect, with your microdosing, what level of doses are you talking about there? And also, and second question with this is, so from, well, maybe even from your own personal experience, but then from what you hear from your patients, is it so with those low doses, are they reporting these differences in food choices and so on? Because, I mean, this is something, of course, that we, in the bigger clinical picture, we don't really tend to. There are no studies focusing on that, what is happening with these low doses and with those questions. So it's very interesting what you might be able to tell us here.
Yeah, it's a great point that there's very little research looking at the microdosing and how it really, you know, if your major outcome metric is weight loss and that's not your goal, it makes it tricky to really evaluate the effectiveness of the medication. So I'm going to use myself as an example. Microdosing for me, we have a 2.5 milligram per ml dose that we use. And microdosing will go between 5 and 20, usually between 5 and 20 units. So 0.125 milligrams up until, I guess, 0.5 milligrams would be the microdosing range. And I'm gonna acknowledge there's a huge spectrum in our sensitivities to the medications. The people who tend to be overweight, pre-diabetic, diabetic, they're much less sensitive to the medication, and they often, you know, microdosing isn't going to work for them. They need to be on the higher dose to have, I mean, I've had patients start on the 0.5 and not have any effects at all. And they tend to be the larger patients. So most of the microdosing patients for me are already not overweight. They're active, they exercise. So I can get away, you know, you look at the FDA recommended starting dose for non-diabetics, I think is 0.25, and I can start at half of that dose. And some of these patients will already at that dose feel an effect. For me, I've spent 6 months between 5 and 15 units, which is 0.125 to 0.3, 0.4 milligrams per week. And the goal was never weight loss. It's controlling. I'll give it a great example. We have a movie theater here called Alamo where they actually serve you dinner that I take my kids. And it used to be that when I went, I would get a martini or two with my dinner and I would get a dessert. And I knew, you know, my problem wasn't weight gain. My problem was those days of being unhealthy because that creates inflammation and that all contributes to cardiovascular risk, among other types of risk. And what that microdosing allowed me to do is control myself to the point where I no longer would get the martini and I no longer get to the dessert. So I'd go there, I'd get the salad, I'd enjoy the movie with my kids, and then I would leave there and not feel like I missed out. It wouldn't be a challenge for me to do that. And so what it does is it gives you that control where you have much more of a say over what you're eating and what you're doing. And that's how I use microdosing.
Okay. You know, that's very interesting. And so it's good to hear as well that works efficiently. So that you do get those effects. I mean, of course, anecdotally, we hear about these kind of things all the time. But yes, too. So you also presumably then have quite a few patients which would report the same thing back to you, I assume.
Yeah. And they're, you know, when I start the conversation, they're very confused because they think of it as a traditional weight loss medication. And I'm saying, no, you're not using it for weight loss. You're not overweight. You have bad habits that aren't contributing to being overweight, but they're contributing to inflammation and increased cardiovascular risk. And so when I get them on these lower medications, the experience is very consistent where it helps with the food choices. It helps them maintain a healthier diet. A lot of the challenging situation, you know, they're in the social environment and then they feel like they have to drink. They feel like they have to have dessert because everyone else is having it. They report having much better control over that. And what I really love is the effect on alcohol. And I've got a number of patients who have noticed that their drive or motivation to drink alcohol is significantly diminished when they're on a GLP-1. And I think that's a really underutilized and underappreciated benefit of the medication.
They also, with the higher normally used doses, there's always this quite large risk of nausea. Do you see that with your patients at all? Or are there any reports there?
Yeah. And that's, you know, so for, I think of it, there's really four categories of patients, and there's the normals. There's two normals. There's the lucky normals. There's some people who are just different. They never get nausea. It doesn't matter what you do. They have a great experience. They lose lots of weight. The typical normals will get nauseated 2 to 3 times a week for about 5 minutes. And that's usually more around 20 units. Or 0.25 milligrams per week. So, but I always start at 10 units. And in fact, if there's patients who are concerned, who I think may be sensitive, like the third category of patients, about 20%, there's a wide spectrum of sensitivity to the medication. I mean, all across the board, I've had patients at 5 units, which is half of the recommended starting dose by the FDA for non-diabetics, that's 0.125, have significant weight loss or significant nausea and vomiting in the first 4 weeks. And so there's some patients who are starting at, you know, we end up backing off and they're at 2 units. I mean, they're going by increments of 2 to 3 units at a time when they need to increase. So they're incredibly sensitive to this medication. And then there's the less sensitive patients. I would say about 5% of the patients I see, and they tend to be a lot bigger, you know, 250, 300 pounds, but they don't really get any kind of weight loss until they're up around 40 to 70 units, like much further on. So a big part of the initial experience is you got to figure out where they are in terms of those categories, and that drives the side effects. And it's a balance. I recommend for all patients to consider starting at 5 or 10 units. The one drawback to starting at 5 units is if they happen to be someone who's less sensitive, it just prolongs the amount of time before they start to see the effects and they get frustrated. But I think as long as they understand that what we're trying to avoid is the nausea and vomiting, because the biggest tragedy is it's a medication that would really benefit them more than any other intervention, but they have such a bad experience in the beginning that they don't want to ever do it again. So I really, you know, you could reasonably start at 0.125 milligrams a week to be really conservative and make sure you identify those sensitive patients first.
Very interesting. Thanks very much. So then, yes, coming back to the cardiovascular side of things. So you're talking about cardiovascular risks, which you want to reduce. But of course, so the drug themselves, do you also see the GLP-1 actually having some level of cardiovascular risk? You know, going to clinical trials, there is, of course, what is reported quite consistently is that there is a slight increase in heart rate when people of a few beats, when people are on the drug. On the other hand, of course, there's also a lot of research, basic research as well, showing that there is direct beneficial effects on the vasculature and also on the heart itself. So where are you with that?
So I would say I do lipid panels on every so there's two major kind of types of testing. I do a lot of testing. All my patients, I have a 25 biomarker test I do initially, and one component of that is a lipid panel that looks at LDL-C, LDL-P, small LDLs. And then on the other side of that, I like getting insulin and fasting blood sugar, because you can use those to determine a HOMA-IR score, which is insulin resistance. So for me, those two are very complementary and helpful for determining cardiovascular risk, right? So the LDL-C is used to determine your 10-year risk of heart attack and stroke, and that's how statins are prescribed. But if you look at those guidelines, the very first recommendation, first 3 to 6 months when your lipids are elevated, is dietary modifications, right? And that's where the GLP-1s are incredibly potent. If you look at the research, there's not a lot of research looking at the effect of GLP-1s on lipids. And that's why there's no recommendations. There's no guidelines recommending GLP-1s for lipid management, because no one's really, I don't think anyone's done that research. No good, really large prospective trial research type studies. The other part of it though, like if when you think about chronic disease and aging, it's inflammation that drives that. And a good lab marker of inflammation is insulin resistance. Insulin resistance isn't just about blood sugar. If people who are insulin resistant if you look at the 13 most common cancers, they have a 12-fold increase of those cancers, because insulin resistance reflects inflammation. They've got a 6-fold increase in Alzheimer's, a 5-fold increase in heart attack and stroke risk. So the more you can reduce insulin resistance, I think the more you reduce the cardiometabolic consequences of the unhealthy lifestyles that we have. And that's in every patient, especially if their HOMA-IR score is above 1.8. As we start these medications and we get them on the diet and we get them exercising, I think those are the two most important interventions. I see the LDLPs come down. I see the small LDLPs come down. There's other lab markers we can use, like oxidized LDL, myeloperoxidase, LPPLA2. Those markers start to come down. And then the insulin resistance score comes down. And if patients ever, you know, there's a small subset of patients who feel like they have a really good diet, but they still have insulin resistance. And I think that's a great opportunity for something like a continuous glucose monitor, because there's something they're eating that's contributing to insulin resistance. I did one of those for a couple of weeks, and it was really interesting. The food that spiked my blood sugar the most of anything I did, and there were times I had dinner with brownies and I had some alcoholic drinks. I was trying to experiment with different things. What spiked my blood sugar the most was actually protein pancakes in the morning. And I didn't expect that. And that's because it was refined carbohydrate that just, based on who I am and my gut microbiome, that gave me the biggest sugar burst of or blood sugar burst of any of the foods I ate. So I think looking at those metrics and using the GLP-1s to really improve your LDLs and your insulin resistance, that's where you get all the benefit with the cardiometabolic measures.
So, I mean, as I said, being a clinical, being a basic scientist, I'm wondering there. So where is that link between GLP-1 and reducing insulin resistance? Of course, what GLP-1 does in the first instance is it boosts the release of insulin. So therefore, of course, you get improvement in your blood sugar levels. But I don't see so directly the how it would increase insulin sensitivity. So where that would be, I guess, more of an indirect effect, but...
I think the major link is creating a state of calorie restriction and improved dietary choices. I think that's what improves insulin sensitivity over time. So yes, it augments insulin release, but I think anyone who's on a much healthier diet if let's say you weren't using a GLP-1, if you ended up switching to a much healthier diet where you're in calorie restriction, I think there's a whole set. So if you look at the molecular mechanisms, there's the AMP kinase pathway and the sirtuin pathways. Those are big longevity pathways, but what they do is they drive mitochondrial homeostasis. So a lot of inflammation happens within the mitochondria. A good example is if you just look at the mitochondria converting glucose to ATP, that process creates free radicals, right? So if you have a normal amount of glucose, your cell has a normal capability of neutralizing those free radicals with antioxidants and other. That's why antioxidant, you know, like I could, my drink, first thing it says is antioxidants, right? So those are really important. The minute you have something like calorie excess, you have excess glucose, you've now created way more free radicals, you've outstripped the cell's ability to manage those free radicals. Now those free radicals go on to damage the protein, RNA, DNA, and structures within the mitochondria. And that's what directly leads to damage, inflammation, and aging and chronic diseases. So I think if you look at the pathways, you know, when you've got damaged mitochondria, there's three things that lead to health. One is creating new healthy mitochondria. One is repairing the damaged mitochondria. Third is getting rid of the mitochondria that are so badly damaged that they're not doing what they're supposed to do and emitting harmful chemicals throughout the cell. The main drivers of that are the AMP kinase and serotonin pathways. And if you look at what stimulates those the most, right? One is calorie restriction. Two is exercise. And then you've got a lot of these other things like metformin. You got resveratrol, berberine, those are all acting, estrogen balancing, those are all acting on the AMP kinase and serotonin pathways. And I think because they're stimulating better mitochondrial health, you're reducing inflammation, and that's how you get a lot, you know, downstream, that's how you're seeing the improved insulin sensitivity and reduce cardiovascular risk. The more you reduce inflammation, I think the less you have cardiovascular risk.
All right. Great. I think that's a great statement for the first half of our podcast. Well, actually, probably even more than halfway through. So, yes, thanks very much. So exciting until now. And so, yes, for everyone listening, if you're enjoying this episode of the GLP-1 podcast show presented by Wisenetics, please remember to subscribe to it, like it, share it with your friends, family. And of course, you can also set notification on your channel so that you don't miss any of the new upcoming episodes. And also, please feel free to leave us comments at any time. Your feedback is really valuable to us. So thank you very much. And now I'm coming back to Dr. Itri. And so we've talked quite a bit about the microdosing, about the cardiovascular effects, cardiovascular risk to reduce those. So when we now think with your patients in the long term and to kind of to build this sustainable nutrition lifestyle habits with these medications, so you started explaining how they reach this, but then do you think that eventually they come off the drug as well, or are they on this drug for life, or how? So with the habits, do they need to be entrained all the time? Or, well, yes, please just enlighten us.
And I think that's a great point, and that comes up. So I try to be as honest and forthright with patients as possible. I think what, and I've seen research to this effect, I think if you have a patient who's had lifelong struggles with being overweight, and they're diabetic and they're morbidly obese, I think it's reasonable to say they're likely going to be on the medication for life. Because there's, I can't really understand what it's like to be someone who's 200 or 300 pounds. There's something different about me genetically and environmentally than there is about these other people. And I think when I counsel these patients now and they ask about getting off, I say, it's always possible to taper off the medication. But if you've had lifelong struggles, if you're diabetic, if you have obesity, you're likely just going to have to stay on the medication for life. And to be honest, I think the medication's been studied for 15 years. I don't know of any long-term consequences other than when you stop the medication, there's potential to put the weight back on. Now, taking those patients out of the equation, I also tell patients once you've hit your goal weight, you need to be on maintenance dosing for at least 6 to 12 months. And that's because the body really wants to go back to its original weight. And I've seen patients who, once they hit the goal weight, if they taper off, they put the weight back on. And that happened to me too. When you have patients who spend at least 6 to 12 months on maintenance dosing, so they switch to monthly dosing instead of, dosing every 3 to 4 weeks instead of every week, if they get their habits, if they're at the end of that 3 to 6 to 12 months, if their habits are really good in terms of the exercise, in terms of the diet, in terms of managing stress, getting good sleep, like you have to have all those in place, because it doesn't matter how good your habits are. What derails your habits are the unanticipated stressful events, the competing priorities, it's poor sleep, you know, major things that happen in life. So you have to not just have the habits, but you have to have a system set up to manage those unanticipated problems that come up. But you have to be happy with your habits. You have to feel like they're comfortable. You have to feel like they're effortless before you come off the medication. And I think, so for someone like me, I actually came off, I started these medications when they first came out by the FDA, partly because I was experimenting. I wanted to know if this would be good to administer to patients. And it became clear within months, yes, this is an incredible medication. My ex-wife had been a fitness competitor. I tried to do some of the things she had done, and it just gives you so much more control over what you eat and taking away the food noise that it just makes, you know, in a stressful life, it already makes it easier. So, my point being that if your habits are good and you come off the medication, you should be able to keep your same lifestyle. So I came off the medications for 4 or 5 months to see what would happen. And I was surprised that I still got full really soon. I didn't feel like I had dessert. I didn't have the food noise happening anymore. And once you've been off the medication for 2 or 3 months, it's out of your system. It takes about 6 weeks to get out of your system. By 2 or 3 months, it's like you've never taken it. But I got to 4 or 5 months, and not all of the good habits stayed. I didn't fall back into any of the old habits. And I think that for a subset of patients who are already reasonably healthy and they want to just make sure that they're staying healthy, they want to clean up their current habits, maybe they had something happen in life where they started developing bad habits, this can be a part-time, this can be a temporary intervention. And so I think it's very reasonable if you fit that profile to expect to get off the medication.
Okay, yes. No, very interesting. So you talked here about food noise as well. So brought up that term, which actually make me wonder. So is that something with your patients there, do you get their different patient groups talking more or less about it? Or is this something that quite regularly comes up? And so would you say the majority of patients who have problems who come to you for your clinic, they say, I'm constantly thinking about food, or I'm thinking about food a lot more than I should? And does food noise, is that a very important factor?
I think that's the number one feedback I get, is it gets rid of food noise. That's the most consistent thing I've heard from patients. And it's either they constantly have food noise, or the most common habit I see is people will do really well through dinner, breakfast through dinner. They did a great job. They exercise, they eat well. But as soon as they're done with dinner and they're sitting there watching TV or doing something else, they can't stop thinking about those treats. That's the food noise that gets them. And that's the worst habit, is you've already eaten dinner. You're not hungry, but you've got this habit of snacking at night right before you go to bed, which is the worst time to snack. And so I think the most consistent feedback I get is that it kills that food noise. It lets them go to bed without having the snack. And it takes like 3 to 4 months to break that bad habit. So once they've been doing this for 4, 5, 6 months, then it becomes a natural part of their daily life. And so that, if that's your problem, then the GLP-1s are a great intervention to help with that.
Okay, so that's very interesting. Also, so what I find very interesting there as well is, so it seems as if you're suggesting that the microdosing is actually sufficient to suppress that food noise in many of your patients, possibly not the most obese, the most overweight, but for a lot of patients, with the microdosing is sufficient to reduce that. Is that correct?
It can be, and that tends to be in patients who are already not overweight. Okay. If you're already 20, 30 pounds overweight, it's unlikely that you're going to have to. Our average weight loss at 10 weeks is 12 pounds. Average weight loss at 18 weeks is 24 pounds. So if you're already looking to lose 20, 30 pounds, you're by definition getting outside of, you're getting up to 40, 70 units easily. So that puts you outside the microdosing. If you're a person who's not overweight to start with, that's most likely where the microdosing is going to be effective and where you don't have to get above 20 units.
Great. Thank you very much. Is there anything else that you would like to share with us that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I'll just say one risk. I think the the biggest risk of these medications, and where I see a lot of patients and providers making a mistake, is getting too aggressive with the weight loss and muscle loss. So as soon as you're losing more than 1 pound a week, you're getting close to the 50-50 muscle to fat that you lose. And if you look at a lot of the big trials, when you look at when people have lost 30 plus pounds, 40 to 60% of that's muscle. So I would say if you're considering or if you're using a GLP-1, that's the biggest risk to me, is you really want to limit your weight loss to no more than a half a pound to a pound a week. Make sure you're doing the resistance training 3 days a week. Make sure you're getting your protein intake. There's a bunch of different metrics people use. The one I like that's very reasonable is 1 gram of protein per pound of lean muscle. And you can get your lean muscle by getting on a biometric scale. It'll tell you how much lean muscle, like I'm 135 pounds of lean muscle. So I have to get 135 grams of protein per day. So I think as long as you're doing those while you're doing a GLP-1, you can actually build muscle while you lose fat. And that's my goal for all of my patients, is not just to lose weight, but to lose fat while they gain muscle, because muscle is a major predictor of longevity, especially as you get older. So that'd be the one last thing, is just be really careful about the muscle loss.
Oh, yes. Very, very important, very interesting point. And of course, so in that respect, little follow-up question still on this one. So, and that's of course, where I'm wondering, thinking about people, well, like myself, not the youngest one anymore. And of course, as we age, we're losing muscle mass. So with the GLP-1 treatments here, and do you see anything with your patients there as well? Is it that younger people respond in a way better, in a more positive way, not losing muscle mass so much than older patients? So as you're coming into your middle age or so, do you need to be even more careful about this?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a big differentiator there is being low hormone. So both, you know, as both men and women, as they get older, and we're talking, I see both men and women in the 30s who are already testosterone deficient because of unhealthy lifestyles and stress. Cortisol has a direct impact on hormone production. The ones who are most at risk for muscle loss are postmenopausal women who are not on HRT. So that would be my, you know, for the older patient who has symptoms of low hormones, and I have screening questions in all my intakes forms for men and women. The fourth intervention to ensure that you not just maintain muscle mass, but actually have an opportunity to gain muscle, is doing testosterone supplementation for both men and women. And so most of my patients come in with a hormonal deficiency, and then the hormone replacement complements GLP-1 treatment so well, because one of the main symptoms of hormone deficiency is weight gain, and especially visceral weight gain, which is pro-inflammatory. So when I combine both of those in an older patient, I have a number of patients who actually gain muscle while they lose weight, and it's just a matter of sticking to that system and doing the hormone repletion at the same time.
Great. Thank you very much. That was a fascinating episode. And so with this, yes, we really are at the end. So I hope our audience, you've enjoyed it. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Itri. And yes, for everyone else, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then please leave us a review as well. Feedback is extremely important for us. Until next time, this is Stefan Trapp from the GLP-1 Podcast Show, signing off now. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.